Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How is convergence changing the nature of public discourse? As regular people use technologies like YouTube, Twitter, and blog sites to seek information and post content of their own, control of the media no longer rests exclusively with a powerful few corporate giants. Optimists hope the growing reach of grassroots politics will breathe new life into American democracy and guarantee citizens permanently enhanced influence on the leaders and even the corporations that serve them. But my guest today says at this point there is nothing inevitable about the outcome of this remarkable time. Everything is up for grabs. Henry Jenkins is founder and director of the Comparative Media Studies Program at MIT. His latest book has just been re-released with an update in paperback. It's called Convergence Culture, Where Old and New Media Collide. Henry, welcome to Think.
Delighted to be here.
You describe convergence not as a battle, but as a collision between old and new media. Can you explain why that distinction is so important?
Well, yeah, I like many of your listeners, I'd been over the last decade reading a variety of critics thinking about the moment of media change we're at. And one group would say we lived in a world where four or five media companies controlled all of the media and information we received, and that was only going to get worse. And I'd read those and say, yeah, that sounds about right. And then I'd read another set of books that said we live in a world where there are no gatekeepers, where anyone can send message to a much broader public than ever before, where new platforms are making it possible for new forms of civic discourse. And I'd read that and say, yes, that sounds about right. But no one was actually describing what seemed to be two totally mutually opposed scenarios, how they was connected to each other. What does it mean to live in a world where old-style media, mass media, is increasingly concentrated and where an emerging style of media is reaching more people than ever before and allowing them to leverage new kinds of power? The Pew Center for Internet and American Life tells us that as many as 60% of teenagers online have produced media, and about a third of teenagers online have shared media they produced with someone beyond their immediate friends and family. That's a sea change. But at the same time, we're seeing these new media platforms being central to the strategies of mass media companies. And so we've got to somehow understand this not as an either-or, not as media concentration versus grassroots participation, but at the intersection between those two trends.
For a long time, it was easy to say that old media, mass media, really didn't understand the needs of people and the way things were changing. Has that finally changed? Have they sort of come over the hump?
Well, I think they're buying a vowel, to borrow a metaphor from their world. I think they're starting to get some clues about what the future relations of mass media to the general public is going to look like. I think that we're seeing increased awareness of the fact that people are watching television content through platforms other than television, and that gives them access to new kinds of information. We're seeing television executives monitor fan discussion groups to get a sense of what the public is thinking and saying on an ongoing basis about their shows. And we're seeing pretty rapid shifts in decision-making around television shows shaped in part from the data they're gathering from that community. We're seeing them use social network sites to rally fans behind programs and to develop a better sense of what those audiences are looking for. Doesn't mean they're fully responsive. I mean, they still are more responsive to advertisers than to the public. The public exists to be sold to advertisers. But it does mean that they are beginning to recognize their long-term viability depends on this very elusive thing they call audience engagement. And they're debating knowing themselves what that word means and how to achieve it, but they're aware now that there are other mechanisms by which they can understand the public besides the Nielsen ratings.
Now, on the other hand, for the time that you have been studying this phenomenon, you have not been as cowed by the idea of big media having the power to control what people think or what information they can find. Do you think other analysts have made too many assumptions about the passivity of audiences before convergence even happened?
Yeah, I mean, I think for a long time there's been a kind of glib assumption among intellectuals that the mass audience was somehow a set of cows that could be corralled by mass media companies, that what they needed was another kind of intelligentsia to reshape their political and cultural agendas. You know, I grew up as a television fan, as part of the science fiction fan world, and what we discovered rather rapidly was people of all class backgrounds, educational backgrounds, were reading books, watching television and film, engaging in passionate and heated discussions about what it all meant in their lives. And those discussions opened them up to new ideas. But collectively, they were forming their own opinions about the media they were consuming. And on an outer fringe 20 years ago, now at the center of it, was the fact that they were producing their own media. For 7 years, science fiction fans have been producing zines about the content of science fiction. Since the 60s, Star Trek fans have been actively reworking the content of television to tell their own stories, often in ways that were radically different from the producers. And we've seen this as an ongoing thing. As I wrote about participatory culture 20 years ago in my book, Textual Poachers, which is my first study of the fan community as a creative and productive community. Now that term participatory culture is being used in a pretty widespread way to talk about what we are all doing with media, that in an era of YouTube and Facebook, we are all more visibly shaping the flow of media and more actively engaged in conversations than ever before. And as we do so, we influence each other as much as we're influenced by mass media attacks.
So where do you stand on the idea of what convergence really is in terms of a force within our culture? Is this power to communicate with other people so much more easily? Does that simply replace the channels that we used before? We would get together in clubs, or we would talk about things, or we would write letters to friends? Or is this entirely unprecedented, the way that we create content and share it with people? Does this actually qualify as a brand new thing?
Well, I think it's some of both. I mean, I think, first of all, we'd say that the roots of our modern convergence culture can be traced through the last 200 years plus of popular use of media, that there's a whole hidden history of media in the United States. We could go back to teenagers in the 19th century who were using toy printing presses to print what we would now call zines and circulate them around the country. The Amateur Press Association started in the mid-19th century. And there's, you know, a long history of these kinds of behavior, using whatever the available tools and platforms are to allow average people to share their views with each other and to engage. But the percentage of people who could engage with it in the past was relatively small compared to the general population. Those practices have gone mainstream, have become much more visible as digital platforms have made it possible for more and more people to participate. The more people who participate, the more visible they become, the more people become aware of them, the more people participate. And so there's been a kind of snowballing effect over the last 15, 20 years where stuff that was absolutely fringe when I first started writing about it at the beginning of my career is absolutely normative practice today. So it's not that the digital has created something from nothing. It's that the social and cultural changes that we're seeing began 100 years ago or more, but that the digital has brought them to more people, has allowed us the scale of operations we never would have imagined before, and in doing so has increased the speed by which it's possible for these groups to interface with each other. So when I first started studying fans, people would send zines through the mail to discuss their response to a television show, and it might take 2 months for you to find out what other fans thought of your favorite episode of Star Trek: The Next Generation. Now, an episode of any television show ends, and probably before the first commercial break, people are starting to post their reactions online, and the conversation unravels in a matter of hours. In the course of a week, many more people will weigh in. Their discussions will get deeper and deeper. There's a kind of gradual elaboration that takes place, and quite a sophisticated interpretation of the show will have emerged in the week between one episode and the next. And that simply is a shift in scale and speed that it's gradually changing the quality of participation.
Henry Jenkins is my guest. He's director of the Comparative Media Studies Program at MIT. His book is called Convergence Culture, Where Old and New Media Collide. I think it's really interesting because for a long time, people were talking about this move to personalize content, that you only had to watch something just for you, or you only had to consume something just for you. In fact, what you have found that rather than this turning into an every man for himself world where everybody is sort of closed off, what we're doing, as it turns out, is creating a sort of collective intelligence.
Yeah, I would say rather than personalizing the media, we're socializing the media, not in the political sense that it's socialist, but in the looser sense that our consumption of media becomes more and more a social phenomenon. So to give an example, about almost 20 years ago, I did a case study of Twin Peaks fans on the Internet. This was a very early Usenet community of fans that were watching the show and responding in real time. And something very interesting was happening with David Lynch's cult television series. The newspaper critics were saying the series had become so complicated that no one could understand it. And the folks online were saying the series had become so simple-minded they were losing interest in it. So the difference was the newspaper critics were watching it by themselves in their living room. The people online were putting information together making elaborate speculations, feeding off of each other, you know, and basically they were coming out with a richer, more sophisticated, more complex show than any network television series was possibly going to be deliver at that point. They were stretching ahead in terms of their demand for complexity because of the ability of many minds working together to process information. We jump forward and we look at a phenomenon like Wikipedia, which, you know, not only deals with a single television show, but pretty much every show on television, every major piece of information on the planet is gradually being assembled by people worldwide, pooling knowledge, working together, arbitrating conflicting claims, deciding what information is valuable and which one isn't, on an ongoing and collective basis. So that we now live in a world where, if anything, television is about as complex as we've ever seen, and schools are dumbing down compared to popular culture. Because schools now hold on to this idea of the autonomous learner, the Renaissance man, the person who knows everything, at a time when no one can possibly know everything. But we can learn to depend on each other for information we need, and we're gradually, as a society, developing complex skills and processes by which we put together information together to do things we couldn't individually accomplish.
Wikipedia has been a fascinating case study because when it first started just a few years ago, it was sort of, a lot of people would sort of joke about it. People knew about it, but they felt like a lot of the information was wrong. And now, I don't know about you, but a lot of people that I respect use it on a regular basis and sort of have learned that it's grown better over the years.
Yeah, I mean, I use it on a daily basis. It's absolutely a central resource for me. And several years ago, I had a chance to sit down with Jimmy Wales, the sort of leader of the Wikipedia movement. And I asked him the obvious question, is Wikipedia accurate? And he said, that's totally the wrong question to ask, that the question you should be asking is, when is Wikipedia accurate? Because Wikipedia is not a product, it's a process. And in each entry is at some point in a continuum between being raw and unprocessed to being fully realized. And to read Wikipedia, you have to be aware of how collective intelligence works, and attentive to the process that's creating these pages. So what you have to do is not just look at the surface level, but go down to the history page, and there you can see the process by which the community is working through this information, trying to decide what's valuable, trying to discern what's accurate, and the page itself provides pretty clear indications of the level of accuracy and trust, the level of trust you should put in the accuracy of the information found there. It's a very different way of thinking about it than what we think when we go and pick up the Encyclopedia Britannica, where we assume some expert out there has put their knowledge in a bound form that's fixed for all time. You know, so that I had a great deal of respect for the Encyclopedia Britannica until I was asked to write an entry, and I suddenly had the humbling realization that I wasn't an expert, that I didn't know enough to feel like by myself you could write an encyclopedia entry and be sure that I knew what I was saying was accurate on the scale that the encyclopedia entry needs to be written. And much better to have a lot of people with very different kinds of expertise and knowledge working together to ensure the accuracy of the product long term.
And your observation has been that people take their Wikipedia responsibilities pretty seriously.
I've spent a long time looking at the Wikipedia, and yeah, my sense is that in fact the people who are invested in it are deeply invested in it. They feel an enormous obligation to ensure the integrity of the information. So that several years ago, Stephen Colbert had this campaign among his viewers to put misinformation on pages dealing with African elephants on Wikipedia. And so he was driving the Colbert Nation to change Wikipedia. And what Jimmy Wales told me was that the Wikipedians gathered together to defend the integrity of the information on the site. That there was a war going on, and Colbert fans would change it, and seconds later, a Wikipedian would change it back. And that sense of banding together to protect the integrity of information is part of what we understand about the ethics and the social commitments behind Wikipedia.
And a fascinating old media, new media convergence. We'll talk more about that in just a minute. Henry Jenkins is my guest. He is director of comparative media studies at MIT. His new book is called Convergence Culture, Where Old and New Media Collide.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering flexible part-time graduate study. You can follow your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Henry Jenkins. He is director and founder of the Comparative Media Studies program at MIT. His award-winning 2006 book has just been updated and re-released in paperback. It's called Convergence Culture, Where Old and New Media Collide. If you want to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372, or you can send an email to think@kera.org. Henry, what does YouTube reflect about American political discourse?
Well, I think YouTube reflects everything and nothing about America. I mean, it has become the crossroads where every group posts its information. But I think we've seen extraordinary uses of YouTube over the last 2 years in the presidential campaign. I mean, to many, many degrees, especially for younger voters, Obama's image was profoundly shaped by a series of YouTube videos, whether we're talking about the original Obama Girl video, whether we're talking about the spoof of the Apple 1984 commercial that sort of pit Obama versus Clinton very early in the process, whether we're talking about the Will I Am, Yes We Can video. Week by week, over the last 2 years, we saw Obama supporters posting videos that appropriated constructed arguments behind Obama as a candidate. We saw biting satires right to the last minute of his various opponents, whether it was Clinton or McCain. Some of you would have seen the parody that took McCain's sort of Sarah Palin speech and just drew over it the hat and umbrella of the penguin, and suddenly you had a different way of thinking about who McCain was and what were sort of strange mannerisms began to take shape as a particular kind of political image. Some of this was fed by the Obama campaign. Some of it was totally autonomous from the Obama campaign. Some of it is in a murky space in between where there might be a loose affiliation, but it really was, in a deep sense, grassroots. Some of it was done by semi-commercial groups that were trying to create content that might pulp them into national visibility and attach themselves to the Obama campaign. But all of it was something that young people particularly responded to, and much of it led to a different language or image set for thinking about what policy is. For many young voters, traditional political discourse is very much inside the beltway, very policy wonkish. It's exclusionary in the sense that you have to already be in the system to understand the arguments the system is constructing for itself. What these videos did was translate that into a language of popular culture parody, which immediately spoke to young people, allowed them to play on their competencies as fans and consumers, and pulled them into the political process by helping them understand politics through a whole different set of metaphors than we've seen before, and giving them a space where they could participate, whether it was creating new videos or simply sending links and passing along commentary and inserting and embedding it in their LiveJournal pages and their Facebook pages and so forth. YouTube gave us a way to talk about the change that was beginning to bubble up from the grassroots level.
So we know that YouTube is democratic in that anybody can post content up there, and theoretically anybody else can find it. But it does have this ranking system that causes, it sort of snowballs after a while. It causes the most popular items to be seen more than anything else, and it becomes a little bit harder to find some of the other things. Does it actually suffer from some of the same kinds of unipolarity that old guard media has been accused of having?
Yeah, I think there's a real danger of that. I think The fact that we have a participatory culture doesn't yet mean or ensure that we have a diverse culture. That a participatory culture means everyone is free to participate. But we haven't yet evolved mechanisms which ensure that we have access to the broadest possible array of perspectives. So if you look at YouTube, John McMurray, an academic researcher who looked at YouTube's top 100 most popular videos and a particular snapshot, found overwhelmingly they were produced by white middle-class males. That diversity existed in YouTube, but diversity was buried in YouTube, so that minority contributors could take content, put it up there. It might spread through minority blogs or minority discussion forums, but it wasn't necessarily going to reach the eyes of the majority of people. So YouTube is already, because it has a ranking system where, quote, the most popular content becomes the most visible content, the result is that minority or diverse perspectives often get buried beneath the surface there. And so we really have to look at how do we develop mechanisms that sort of curate things like YouTube, that encourage diversity, that create platforms by which we can see difference. The other problem there is what I call the participation gap. And just as for the last 20 years we've been struggling against the digital divide, which has to do with access to technologies, we now have to struggle against the participation gap, which is the set of social and cultural practices that make it harder for some groups to participate than others. There is a sense of entitlement or empowerment that white middle class suburban kids feel as they relate to technology, where they have access to it 24/7, it's their world and they know how to deal with it, versus groups that may have much more limited access through schools and public libraries, who may not yet feel comfortable moving into the spaces of YouTube or discussion list or, you know, the blogosphere, and who may not have the educational resources to become full participants in it. So some of the work that we're doing right now with the MacArthur Foundation on what we call new media literacies is designed to combat this participation gap, to ensure that every kid in America has the social skills and cultural competencies needed to fully participate in these new participatory platforms.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. The email address is think@kera.org. Speaking this hour with Henry Jenkins. His book is called Convergence Culture, Where Old and New Media Collide. Let's speak to Ken in Plano. Hey, Ken.
Hi. I'm going to comment leading to a question. Go with me just a second. Right now, in the home video, there's a big argument about what direction how people are going to get their movies, whether it's from a little tiny disc, a 5-inch disc that's a Blu-ray, or is it going to be downloadable? And my question to your guest is, the buying and selling of information is part of the human experience. It's a necessity. But there's so many newspapers going out of existence. There's so much pressure for these companies to make money right now, and they're just not making any money. I was wondering how your guest felt that the business model will change with regard to the buying and selling of news in this new era. Thank you very much.
Thanks for your call.
All right, so to take both of those questions, the first one about video distribution, I think what we're going to see for the foreseeable future is there are going to be more and more different ways we absorb entertainment content. That, you know, not only will it be a choice between do we watch it live on television or via a digital video recorder or downloading on the internet, but there will be multiple schemes for downloading content, so that Hulu, which you airs commercials, will exist alongside iTunes, where you buy content directly. And I don't think we're going to see a consolidation of options. I think we're going to see a proliferation of choices, because different people want to watch different kinds of video content in different ways, in different moments, through different platforms. And I think the industry is going to have to be flexible to be where they want to be when they want it there, because otherwise they'll take it where they want it illegally, if not legally. So it's about keeping in touch with diversification of desire. Now, in terms of news, it's a much more vexing problem, I think. My prediction would be that newspapers in some form survive, but the chances of many newspapers surviving goes down. That I think what we're going to likely, we've seen over the last 40 or 50 years, a consolidation from 4 or 5 papers in major cities each day to 1 or 2 papers in cities each day, a gradual consolidation that's taking place. I think this next step out from that is going to be regional consolidation. I think in my region up in the Northeast, it's unlikely that Hartford and Providence couldn't continue to support newspapers, and my prediction would be that those get absorbed by the Boston Globe, and then this sort of snowballs out. Because what we're seeing is most Americans get their news from national sources, USA Today, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Christian Science Monitor, rather than from local sources. And this has been the norm, of course, in countries around the world for a long time, that United States is almost unique in having local newspapers in quite the ways that we do. Some of the functions of local newspapers are being replaced by hyper-local news sources online. These would be things like place blogs, blogs that cover specific neighborhoods and communities. But in the long run, there's going to be a gap, and we're struggling with how we fill that gap between regional or national news and the demands of people living on the ground in specific communities. And I think that's the big challenge that's facing the news industry today.
Do you think information seekers are more tolerant of hyper-local news being created and filled by non-professional journalists? You know, there's a business model. A lot of, hard copy newspapers are going out of neighborhoods, and they're written by people who get money. Do you think that will probably evaporate at some point?
I mean, I think there is a sense that the most local news is also perhaps the most informal, the most personal news that's written by people who actually live in that community. And so all signs are, I think, that very hyper-local stuff will continue to grow. just as, say, neighbor newspapers have tended to continue to do better than in terms of attracting local advertising revenue and so forth than citywide newspapers. So I think it's the city and state papers that are most at risk at the present time. And, you know, I think some of the functions they serve, we're going to have to figure out how, other ways to deal with.
Let's talk for a little bit about how this convergence played out in the recent elections. You have a great additional chapter in the new issue of the book that talks about the CNN YouTube debate that, that took place for the Democratic for the Republican primary candidates. Can you talk about how that played out?
Yeah, I think it was a very interesting moment in time where CNN, you know, an icon of establishment media, partnered with YouTube, which is probably the icon of the new Web 2.0 participatory culture, to stand through this debate. About 3,000 or 4,000 people submitted videos online that they thought hoped could be used to form questions for the Democratic and Republican candidates, for the Democratic candidates. Another 4,000 or 5,000 did it for the Republican candidates. These were then vetted by the CNN producers, who chose which spots went on the air. Even, you know, so there was a heated debate about whether the decision should be made by the consumers at large through a collective intelligence mechanism, or whether we should have sort of professional journalists decide what the final questions are going to be. The debate unfolds, and it's really quite a remarkable exchange, because the candidates quickly discovered they could not use their sound bites in talking to people who were posting questions from their own home, asking things in very informal language, and asking them about things that were not part of the fixed agenda the national media had focused on. Only questions about Darfur and the debates that I saw. The only questions about gay rights in the debates that I saw. They were questions about gun ownership, you know, about very local issues that emerged in that platform, about the minimum wage. At the same time, the most famous video was one featuring a snowman who asked a question about global warming. And this rapidly was used by the mainstream media to make fun of the debates, how they trivialized American politics, how presidential candidates were forced to address questions from snowmen. We trace back the snowman video. It turns out to be a really remarkable story. It was in part inspired by the Mr. Bill segments on Saturday Night Live.
The little play guy.
If we go back to the original Mr. Bill, they were sort of amateur-produced content in the 1970s that went forward. Mr. Bill's producers had recently started making environmentally conscious videos and reviving the character. And so the use of the snowman as a tribute to talk about global warming seemed like an altogether appropriate political tack.
Mm-hmm. You have noted that when given the chance, Americans like to sort of disrupt things with something somewhat more creative, if they can sort of break their way into what they might consider to be mainstream media, at least based on the number of sort of joke videos that were submitted to CNN through the YouTube project. What does that tell you about the way people feel cut off from traditional media?
Yeah, this is what I call the power to negate. And basically the point is that given a chance to change mainstream media, our first impulse is to disrupt its normal practices so we can see that it's actually responding to us. And I think it does express a sense of alienation, exclusion, a loss of control, a feeling that mass media often doesn't respond to them. So the way you do that is to force them to act against their will. So in the YouTube debate, people were sending in videos asking whether Arnold Schwarzenegger was really a Terminator, talking about Roswell. We had a Viking talking about immigration issues. The sort of idea was to just sort of force the mainstream media to include questions that were totally absurd and were not business as usual. Same time, we were seeing fans of American Idol having a Vote for the Worst campaign to try to keep bad singers on the air as long as possible. Or we saw the case some years ago when People magazine ran a contest for the most beautiful person in America, and Hank the Angry Drunken Dwarf sort of won the contest over Leo DiCaprio. You know, we're seeing this again and again, the sense that when given an open platform, the public will first response is to use it to flex its muscles, to demonstrate that mass media finally has to listen to them, and the clearest way to demonstrate it is to force them to punch themselves in the face.
Do you think that novelty ultimately will wear off as people become more accustomed to the idea that they can, in fact, have a say in what gets out there in the media?
I'm fully convinced it will. I think as we've started to see more established relationships, people begin to feel comfortable that their power is being felt, that their voices are being listened to, they begin to take that responsibility very, very seriously. And there are any number of cases we could look at groups of fans worked with producers to try to improve the quality of the programming, where citizens worked with political leaders to try to improve the society, that this is something that it's about building that trust and having the sense that this system, you know, reflects them. The parallel to the power to negate is the power to marginalize. And what we saw, say, in the CNN YouTube debate is a certain number of the questions got translated into here are some examples of goofy questions we received, often in ways that didn't reflect the political stakes of the people who submitted the questions, that they were in the news media, CNN was indiscriminate about whether what they were making fun of were actually eccentric questions or disruptive questions, or questions that were being posed in a novel, different way than what politics as usual looks like. And so as long as the mass media uses its power to marginalize the voices of average citizens, it's going to have a hard time building the trust necessary for responsible participation. And I think that's part of the negotiations that are taking place around more the relations between mass media and participatory culture right now.
Do you find that, people who work within the standard old guard mass media are somewhat defensive and marginalized, maybe on purpose to make sure that their foothold is strong?
I mean, I think, you know, just as I said earlier, that I think a lot of academics and activists want to have democracy without putting much faith in the public. I think what we see with mass media is that it's the executives don't trust the people very much. They do hold them in contempt. They hold themselves in contempt for feeding a system that they think is probably the lowest common denominator that hasn't realized its full potential. And they blame the public for forcing their hands away from doing what they think would be quality production. And so there's a kind of look down your nose as the public. The public clearly doesn't know as much as we do. The public clearly isn't able to exercise reasonable choice and decision. You know, it's hard to believe we're in a society where the public chooses the president and the public serves on juries that determine the life and death of, you know, of accused, felons, that we can't have a system where they can decide what a good television show looks like.
Henry Jenkins is my guest. He's director of the Comparative Media Studies program at MIT. His book is called Convergence Culture, Where Old and New Media Collide. If you want to join us, send email to think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering flexible part-time graduate study. You can follow your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Henry Jenkins. He is founder and director of the Comparative Media Studies program at MIT. His book is called Convergence Culture, Where Old and New Media Collide. It was first published in 2006, but has been updated and now released in paperback. If you'd like to join the conversation, our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. The email address is think@kera.org. Let's speak to Anthony in Dallas. Hello, Anthony.
Hi. I was wondering if your guest could comment about the situation with movie theaters, if they could compete with kind of the media convergence, the new media that's coming out, or even keep up with. I mean, you know, with every additional technology, they kind of lose a foothold, you know, with the inventions of, like, home theater systems and DVDs and Blu-rays. I was wondering if your guest feels that, you know, is there a possibility for this, you know, kind of old-fashioned market to continue, or are movie theaters going to go the way of Betamax? Thank you.
Thanks for calling.
Well, I think the first observation I make is that there are no dead media, that, you know, once we've created a major medium of expression, it tends to survive. The delivery mechanism shifts, but the medium itself doesn't go away. So I don't see a death of cinema or a death of television or a death of theater or a death of print. Now, the film theater, you know, we may well be moving away from, it's been predicted for the last decade, we move away from a situation where celluloid projection is taking place in every projection booth in the country to a place where digital projection can occur simultaneously across a region or across the nation from a centralized location. The movies we may watch on our screen could well be digital. We're seeing theaters already experiment with this rather than celluloid-based projection, and I think that would have some consequence. The other question is, we saw over the last 20 or 30 years a proliferation of screens, as it made more economic sense to support and maximize the number of options available in any given theater so that if one film failed, we'd go to see something else. Overall, the system is still making money. It's just, you know, that many more films are failing because many more films are getting out there. And the question is whether some of those second-tier films that are never going to be the top box office films are going to gain greater visibility and distribution online than are going to ever receive visibility on a movie screen. So we could move back to a system where there is a smaller number of screens, where the big blockbusters go to a movie theater and make money over an extended period of time, and the secondary titles come directly to DVD, come directly to digital distribution, and we watch those films through our home movie theaters rather than at the theater. But I don't think the social, you know, the phenomenon of the big movie, the latest example being Twilight, is going to go away. And I think there still will be a support for films like Twilight and Iron Man and Dark Knight Returns and Watchmen and any number of other films that are just going to generate a lot of interest. And the people want that experience of watching them in a mass, of feeling the visceral excitement of everyone, you know, squealing and ooing and, you know, gasping at the same time, or everyone laughing at the same time. We want that experience in public. We don't want that personalized.
We've heard a lot of people predicting that, you know, a television show that a lot of people like goes off the air and everyone's upset, and you hear about people getting together and they want any episodes that were not aired and they want to have control. We haven't seen a lot of really powerful examples of this happening where public demand really mandates production for a select group of viewers. Do you think that will happen ultimately?
I think it's a direction we're going to go in. I think the clearest sign that this might work was Joss Whedon's Dr. Horrible sing-along blog last summer, where Whedon, during the writer's strike, sort of said, well, what if I made an experimental project? I made a limited run of small, short episodes for the web. I'm going to give them away free for a week, then I'm going to move them to iTunes and see if people will pay for it. I've heard various claims, whether it was within 48 hours or a week, that he earned back the entire production cost of the series, and everything since then has been gravy. That's led to all kinds of other Dr. Horrible content, webcomics, T-shirts, you know, DVD sets beginning to be built. It was an experiment to see whether a creator, Whedon, who had done Firefly, who had done Buffy, who had done Angel, as a clear cult following, would be an early adapter of this approach, but whether he could generate enough public buzz without any broadcast to begin to support subscription-based content. And I think the answer is yes. I think over the last year or two, we've seen other experiments of pretty well-known media producers beginning to do short video work for the web that's getting financial support from viewers, and we're beginning to get a robust platform for that. So I would predict within the next 3 to 5 years, we will see a major television series that either begins and goes directly to DVD or the web and is supported long-term, its production costs are supported by the viewers, or a show that's canceled still has a strong but narrow niche following that spins off from television and goes directly into production. There have been a lot of, you know, there's some rights issues involved in that. There are some union issues involved with that still have to be worked through, you know, and people still have to figure out what the repricing is and what the you know, how long, what the units you're going to, how far in advance people would subscribe to content before they started to receive it. Lots of questions there are still to be experimented with, but I think it's the direction things are moving.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next to Tim in Fort Worth. Hey, Tim.
Hey, I was, I'm sort of involved, I guess, in the sports media, so I might have some bias here, and I'll do my best to ask this question without that much bias to it. But I read a article referencing a guy named Negroponte from MIT that the guest might be familiar with, and was hoping to get his comment on some research that Disney, ABC, ESPN had generated, suggesting that Negroponte was somehow wrong, that online viewership would exceed television viewership by now. And my argument, you know, I guess, or my question is that it seems to me that the networks themselves are standing in the way of a pile of media advertising dollars that would be available to them in regard to, you know, just providing games, for example, the Texas versus Texas A&M game. And again, this is my sports bias coming out. was unavailable to people to watch via the internet. And, you know, my argument is if you're watching the internet on your television screen in your home and you get your internet from the cable company, it almost seems like a semantic argument of whether or not you're watching TV or the internet. And so I was just kind of seeking the, you know, the guest comments to comment on that opportunity to earn those advertising dollars that seems to me to be kind of being wasted by traditional media.
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, great question. I'm going to probably be less successful at fully addressing the sports dimensions of it than the general implications. But yeah, I think this is a tension right now, that they're clearly, I think the networks clearly would like to demonstrate that the potential for online viewership is much lower than it really is. But I think they've gradually, with the success of Hulu in the last year or two, started to recognize that large numbers of people are choosing to watch television online rather than watching it download, and that many of them are seeking content that may simply not be available to them in their local area, given the vagaries of, you know, cable companies and what they carry and what they don't carry. Others are seeking content that they may have missed an episode, or friends are talking about a series that's already started and they want to start catching up on it. There are lots of reasons to watch content online. So a recent snapshot of this would be Sarah Palin's appearance on Saturday Night Live, following the Tina Fey sketches. Sarah Palin's appearance resulted in the highest ratings that Saturday Night Live has received in the last 10 years. But something like five times that number of people watched that Sarah Palin-Tina Fey sketch online. And many, many more people, it wasn't just teenagers, were choosing to use the online media to watch that content. And that was sort of a shock, I think, to television executives, quite how much even a successful television rating success might be capped off by this seeking of content online. This was the central issue of the writer's strike and will be the central issue of the actor's strike if it happens, was this question of how do we evaluate the online component of television production? How do we distribute revenue? How do we create value through advertising? So this is something that's ripping the industry apart right now. And my bet is that, yes, if you get a survey done by television executives, it's in their best interest to downplay the amount of migration from aired broadcast television to download television that's actually taking place. So my bet is that, yes, there are issues around sports as well, complicated issues because of the exclusive contracts negotiated by teams and the television networks, and then in turn for the cable TV stations between the networks and their cable affiliates. There's a lot that they have to work through before they're going to get to the point where they could even do what you're suggesting. But I can't believe, based on what we're observing elsewhere, that there wouldn't be a very strong viewership for games that are not offered currently on television to viewers who live out in the wrong areas of the country.
What is media literacy in the 21st century, an appropriate level of media literacy?
Well, this is something I wrote a white paper for the MacArthur Foundation that really tries to lay out a framework for thinking about media literacy in the 21st century. The first thing I'd say is that we wouldn't declare someone as literate if they could read but they couldn't write. So many of the notions of media literacy in the 19th century were based, or in the 20th century, were based on the idea of critical consumption of existing media. We now have to recognize the need for skills to produce, circulate media, skills at networking, at collective intelligence. So in the white paper, I identify 11 cultural competencies and social skills that we think are essential to becoming part of this new participatory culture. Now, it's worth saying this is not about displacing traditional literacy with media literacy. The bottom line is if you can't read and write, you can't participate meaningfully in these new forms of expression either. That's still the bedrock. But it is no longer sufficient to say we've taught someone to communicate if we've taught them how to read and write. We also have to help them learn how to communicate their ideas through all of these other platforms and how to relate as human being to human beings in online spaces. We also have to teach them a set of ethics by which to evaluate the choices they're making and the consequences of those choices as they move in the online world. So part of what we've done after the white paper is we're beginning to develop materials for schools and after-school programs to help them create opportunities to teach students about these new literacies. And a lot of that we're going to be rolling out over the next couple of years.
One of the things that you say that the young people really need to do now is be trained to work collaboratively, which is not the sort of thing that they're ever tested on in most schools.
No, I most schools today are still hung up on the idea of the autonomous learner. So almost all forms of collaboration in current schooling are called cheating. right? We've made them outside the bounds. Doesn't mean that they don't go on, that kids don't get together and form study groups, or they don't work on their papers side by side, but they have to cover their tracks. They have to mask the collaboration that's taking place rather than bringing it fully into the classroom. It's not even a matter of group work as it's currently constituted, because as long as your expectation is that every person knows everything, then no one is allowed to fully develop an expertise. And collective intelligence is based on the idea of people with many different expertises working together, of people taking ownership and responsibility for some subset of the information they're involved with and sharing that with other students in the classroom space. That's the ideal, not a world where everyone can pass a standardized test because they all know the same things, but a world where any given person feels a sense of real mastery over some section of the content and enough of a shared framework that they can pool resources and understand the arguments being made by other people around them.
So do we have an obligation to contribute content to this collective intelligence that's growing around us?
I mean, I would say I think increasingly there is a social obligation to contribute. I mean, let's go back to Wikipedia. You know, that's one of the things people have noted about Wikipedia is a lack of sense of proportion compared to other encyclopedias. So at the basic level, the entry on Isaac Asimov is considerably longer than the entry on Woodrow Wilson, despite the fact most of us would think Woodrow Wilson had a greater role to play in human history. That's because the technical expertise of the Wikipedia community outbalances those people who have a stronger interest in traditional politics. There are all kinds of ideas and figures in history who are not represented in Wikipedia because of what people talk about as systemic bias. It reflects who participates. A collective intelligence depends on diversity. The more diverse your participants are, the richer the knowledge base for everyone involved, the better the solution you arrive at. So that means that not only do you have an obligation to contribute what you know to the group as a whole, but on the other side, you have an obligation and desperate need to promote diversity, to embrace people whose views are different from your own, whose knowledge is different, whose experience is different, and ensure that their voices are heard for the good of the group as a whole. And so that's part of an ethic that has to emerge around an era of collective intelligence. Now, people are often hear the term collective intelligence and imagine some sort of groupthink or hive mind, some loss of individuality. And in fact, collective intelligence really encourages individuality, diversification, multiplicity of perspectives. It works best when everyone is different and everyone contributes what they know and challenges the emerging consensus of the group. It's not about everyone thinking the same thing. It's about everyone benefiting from the group activity.
Henry Jenkins is founder and director of the Comparative Media Studies Program at MIT. His book is called Convergence Culture, Where Old and New Media Collide. Henry, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for spending the hour.
My pleasure talking to you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.